everyone. I'm Grace.
And I'm Zoe.
The Dead Language Ladies. So our question for today is, did Virgil write fan fiction?
So first of all, we're going to be talking today mainly about Virgil's Aeneid, his famous epic in the style of Homer in many ways. It was written in the first century BC.
Yeah, late first century BC. We don't know exactly when he started writing it, probably shortly after the Battle of Actium, so around the year 30 BC. And then Virgil actually never saw the poem published. He died suddenly of an illness in the year 19 BC. And Virgil actually wanted the Aeneid to be burned. And we'll maybe get into the implications of that a little bit later on in the episode. But of course, it was not burned. And his friends, after his death, ended up kind of editing it and releasing it to the public. So yes, yeah, so we're in the late first century
BC.
I mean,
What would we do without that?
Many Latin students on their first reading of the Aeneid. It's not easy Latin.
No.
So they might wish that it had been burned after all. But I agree. Thankfully, we have it because it is really a fascinating cultural document and just, you know, good literature.
Yeah. So the Aeneid, as per its name, kind of like how the Iliad is about Troy. The Aeneid is about Aeneas.
But who is Aeneas?
Who is Aeneas? So he's a Trojan hero. He's the son of Anchises and Venus.
Aphrodite in Greek.
And this sort of leads me into the first time Aeneas as a character is kind of introduced. It was in the Homeric hymn to Aphrodite. So we learn of Aeneas first in Greek literature. Virgil's not the first person to bring him up. Hence the question, did he write fan fiction? Right. So he first comes into play in the Homeric hymn to Aphrodite. And Aphrodite is his mother. And supposedly in this hymn, we learn that his name comes from the Greek word einon, terrible, in the phrase terrible grief, because her son by Anchises was going to be mortal and die. And the whole hymn is about how she was like kind of tricked because she was making Zeus fall in love with all these mortals. Zeus makes her fall in love with this mortal guy, and so she sleeps with him and has a son. And that's kind of like the first time Aeneas is introduced, at least it seems like it. I mean, it's hard to say when things are written or, you know.
Right. All these stories are like, yeah, super ancient, but Aeneas is clearly like, he long predates the Romans.
Exactly. That's the important thing to remember. And by his, you know, being the son of Anchises, he is the second cousin to Hector and Paris, who are the sons of Priam, the king of Troy.
So he plays a pretty important part in the Iliad too, if I remember correctly.
Yes. And I will mention one more thing I forgot, but that happens in the hymn that feels relevant, is that Aphrodite tells Anchises not to tell anyone that this happened, and that she's the like mother of his son.
Right. She's but embarrassed later, to have fallen in love with a mortal.
So he brags later, he's like, I slept with her, blah, blah, blah. Like, you know, my son's, you know, his mother is Aphrodite. And so Zeus strikes him down strikes his leg or foot or something with his lightning bolt and makes him lame, which is lame as in he can't walk properly. So he has to be carried from Troy, which we learn of in the Iliad.
Yeah.
A little.
And that's, not it's really. Also, there's a super, I mean, that's a very important part in the Aeneid for sure, is Aeneas like carrying his father. And there's a really famous statue.
Yes.
Of
which
Aeneas.
We saw one version of it in Merida, I think.
Yeah.
I remember that one because, you know, this is such an iconic thing and we saw it. We're like, oh, The statue was in Spain. Okay.
Yeah, it's super famous iconography of Aeneas carrying his father on his back as he escapes from Troy. And almost like a stock image. Like, this was just how you portrayed Aeneas, even in antiquity.
Which makes me wonder if, like, that was, even though it's not explicitly in the Iliad,
mm-hmm.
if that's not what they understood happened. Or if there were maybe songs about it that just made that a concrete, like, part of the story, even if it's not in Homer's epics.
Right. I mean, definitely there were so many oral traditions circulating around that we just don't have access to anymore. And I mean, Virgil might not even have had access to them either, but clearly it's such an ingrained part of the tradition of Aeneas.
Yeah. I mean, he could have literally, like us, seen a statue of it.
Exactly.
By some, right? And then been like, oh, this is everyone knows that's what happens because there's a statue commemorating that. I mean, could be something like that. No one knows. But he was a minor character in Homer's Iliad. The two scenes we have with him are interesting. He's saved from death two times by the gods.
Destined for greater
things. And it sort of seems like, yes, they don't say explicitly, he will be the founder of Rome. No.
Well, I mean, the time that the Iliad and the Odyssey were being composed, Rome didn't exist. So. Right.
And so if there was a prophecy, well, there was kind of, I think he was destined to found a Trojan race far away. I think that's the most explicit it gets. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure Poseidon says that.
Yeah, that's right.
When he saves him from combat with Achilles, who's about to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
And I just first of all, before we get into that fight, I think another thing that I sort of forgot about him, but no one does in the Iliad, is that he's kind of slighted by Priam. Like, he's the second cousin to Hector and Paris, and it seems like everyone kind of knows, even Achilles, that Aeneas is not honored as much as maybe he should be mm-hmm. by the king of the Trojans.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's not given as much honor. Yeah. And so it's kind of something that Achilles taunts him about. He's like, oh, like, you know, did he give you enough honors to fight me? Things like that. Achilles was really, rereading that scene, I found it really funny. It was super amusing. They're back, like, Achilles was taunting him like crazy. And then Aeneas is like, let's not taunt each other like little children.
Mm-hmm.
like we're on the playground, you know?
Yeah.
Let's actually fight.
Yeah.
And then Poseidon saves him. And he's like, oh, like Apollo, the sun god, would be really upset if you died. Like, you have a bigger role to play later.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to save you. And I think he even says things like, what were you thinking fighting Achilles? He's such a better man than you. Like, he's the gods love him way more than you. Like, they would let you die.
Like,
what
for real.
Are you doing?
There's definitely a sense that Aeneas is kind of destined for better things, but also, in a sense, has to prove himself.
And that really sets up, like, if there was no, like, you know, Homer doesn't go into Aeneas' story in the Odyssey. It is focused on Odysseus. And Odysseus, the Odyssey in that way feels like it feels like a kind of fan fiction of the Iliad, where it's like you take one character and you expand it into this mm-hmm. huge story.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could almost say Virgil seems to be trying to put the Aeneid on the level of the Odyssey as like, oh, well, the Greek side did this, but guess what? The Trojan side had a very similar arc
mm-hmm.
and it's focused on Aeneas, who was very, like, in a very murky way, destined for some unknown thing.
Right.
And as, like, someone who's dabbled in fan fiction in that world, this is, like, a perfect character to pluck out of a famous story, and just, you have so much room
mm-hmm.
to say whatever you want about what happened to him.
Right, exactly. So, Virgil was not the first person to link Aeneas to the foundation of Rome. So, like Zoe just said, in the Iliad, there's this sense that Aeneas is destined to go on and continue the Trojan race in some way by founding a new civilization far away. Of course, you know, Rome did not exist. It was, you know, people were living in Italy, but it was, you know, small villages. As Rome became increasingly powerful, especially in like the 4th and the 3rd centuries BC, they're also coming increasingly into contact with the Greek world, with the Mediterranean world. And for that reason, both the Greeks and the Romans kind of have a need, a desire to somehow assimilate the Romans and their history into this, you know, established tradition of the Trojan War cycle that was so important for the Greeks. And Aeneas is kind of a natural linking figure, right? He was the one destined to escape and found a new civilization in the West. What's that civilization? Oh, I guess it's Rome. Okay, great. Makes sense. However, the Romans themselves already had Romulus and Remus, right? They already had that narrative.
The twins.
So, like, how do you reconcile this, right? Is Aeneas the founder of Rome? If Aeneas founded Rome, then do we just have to get rid of Romulus and Remus? So there were a couple different ways over the centuries that the Romans kind of tried to negotiate this. The one that Virgil tells us, which has become kind of the canonical accepted version because it was the one that Virgil told, is that Aeneas founds a different city in Italy called Lavinium, which is what we read about towards the end of the Aeneid. Then after several generations of Aeneas's descendants, then we get to Romulus and Remus. So Aeneas is like a great, 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 however many times, grandfather of Romulus and Remus. So in that sense, Aeneas doesn't directly found Rome, but he's still kind of implicated in the rise of Rome. And that also kind of helps to link Rome to all the other cities in Italy as well. So it was a very expedient narrative for the Romans to take this minor character of the Iliad and kind of turn him into their own forefather.
Yeah. And I think it was pretty successful on that front.
Yes.
And, you know, it's trying to establish this epic kind of in parallel to Homer, maybe even on the level of Homer in some ways. And we see that throughout the poem. So I think I'm going to start with the very first line, of course, super famous. The first three words, arma vidumque cano, I sing of arms and the man. Although in Latin, it starts with the word arma, arms, weapons, you know. So it's, and later, a few lines down, he calls upon the muse. That's obviously very similar to Homer. Homer calls upon the muse, you know, to help him sing. And then also, it usually, the Odyssey and the Iliad both start with a really important word. The Iliad with wrath, and the Odyssey with man, which is kind of in an inverted form, the Aeneid.
Yeah, so what's actually really interesting about this first line is, you're right, it's Virgil is announcing that he's not rewriting the Iliad and not rewriting the Odyssey, but combining them together. And we'll actually see that the first, so the Aeneid is in 12 books. The first six books kind of model the plot line of the Odyssey, and the last six books model the plot line of the Iliad. And with these first three words, arma ruumque cano, Virgil is telling us that he's combining both the Iliad and the Odyssey. So the Iliad in the sense of arma, right, warfare, wrath, and then virum, man, literally translates the first word of the Odyssey, which is andra in Greek. But what's really interesting is that andra sounds like arma. So the first word of the Aeneid, arma, actually sounds like the first word of the Odyssey, andra. So Virgil's doing a lot of different things here in his creative reworking of both the sounds and the content of the Homeric poetry.
And I think a lot of the beginning part, I would say the first half of the story, well, maybe a little less than that, is narrated by Aeneas explaining to Dido.
Yeah, and books that's just kind of 2 and 3.
Skipping over the first book. The first book sort of sets up everything. And then essentially Aeneas, it comes to Carthage where Dido is, and he's telling her, you know, the whole story of how he escaped Troy in the battle. And obviously a framing narrative, like Odysseus has a lot of those, where he's telling the Phaeacians his story, telling all these people his story. So there's once more an instance of Virgil kind of imitating that style. And it works really well for the storytelling, that kind of an embedded narrative. And so who's Dido? Because maybe we should talk first about, I'm going to backtrack, actually. I'm going to talk first about his leaving Troy.
Yeah.
Because I feel like the thing that strikes me the most, obviously we already talked about Anchises having to carry him out with his wife and his son. And it's because he realizes they have to leave. There's no way they're going to defeat the Greeks at this point in time. The Trojan the horse has already come in.
And
the
Greeks actually
have already killed Priam.
The ghost of Hector appears to him and tells him to leave. So Aeneas is receiving all these signs telling him, like, you know,
you gotta go.
You've got to get out of here. Don't try and, you know, sacrifice yourself in the fight to defend your city. Like, you're meant for greater things. Get out of here.
AKA Rome.
Yeah.
So in his flight, though, something horrible happens. His wife, Creusa, is lost. We don't know what happens to her. I mean, she dies, obviously, but he just misses her in the crowd, which is kind of like, I mean, and we'll probably touch upon this a lot. I at least see Aeneas as a kind of counterpoint in some ways to Achilles, of course. Like you said, there's a kind of like, you know, there's Iliad and Odyssey are both being referenced. So there is, you know, a parallel to Achilles, but there's a lot of parallels to me between him and Odysseus, because Aeneas is called like pious Aeneas.
Right.
And then Odysseus is always that wily false Odysseus. And so the funny thing for me is, you know, Aeneas is supposed to set up this race of Romans and he loses his wife in the crowd. Like,
it doesn't start out too great.
Like, and then he, you know, when he realizes, he goes back into the Troy, literally all the way back to their house in the midst of everything. And the ghost of Creusa appears to him and's like, you got to go. Not only are you destined for more things, but you have a new wife waiting for you. I read that, like, thinking of Penelope.
Yeah.
Never. Penelope would never.
No.
It's just crazy to me that that's even a thing. But, and then he tries to hug her, goes three times, but fails. That's exactly like Odysseus in the underworld with his mother.
Mm-hmm.
But again, he's trying to, like, hug his wife. Odysseus is with, like, it's funny that, I don't know, it's a weird contrast.
Yeah, absolutely. When you consider Odysseus's goal is always Penelope, right? That's kind of been replaced here by Rome. It's almost like, you know, Italy.
Roma, if you will.
Indeed. Roma et Italia. That's, you know, Aeneas's true love, not Penelope. Certainly not Creusa.
So now that we have established that, he leaves, right? Creusa, yeah. Everyone's telling him, get out. You have a kingdom to establish and a wife to meet, a race to birth, and it's not going to happen here. But he gets waylaid by a storm, and he shows up at Carthage, which again is pointing to Rome's history.
Yeah.
In an interesting way. And Dido is a Phoenician princess?
Phoenician queen. Yes.
Not princess, queen.
She had to flee. So Aeneas, there's a lot of interesting parallels between Aeneas and Dido. Both of them are refugees. They've been forced to leave their homelands. Dido was the queen of Tyre, which is a city in Phoenicia. Interestingly, she's, of course, a character in the Aeneid, but she's also a real historical figure. Certainly, you know, the date that scholars think the Trojan War happened was, I think, about 400 years earlier than when the historical Dido lived. So there was never any meeting between Dido and, you know, any of the Trojan War heroes. But she was a real individual. historical individual that had kind of become mythologized by the time that Virgil was writing. So she was the queen of Tyre, and she was ruling with her husband. This is the story that Virgil tells us. She was ruling there with her husband. Her brother, out of jealousy, killed her husband, the king. So Dido had to flee, and she took some of the Phoenicians with her, and they come to Carthage in North Africa and establish a new city. And in the poem, when Aeneas arrives, we see Dido still kind of in the process of building her city. And there's a clear parallel here, actually, interestingly, to the city that Aeneas is going to have to build, right? He kind of sees Dido building her city, and he's jealous because he's not settled yet, whereas she is.
Basically, all of this is leading up to Aeneas meeting Dido, where, again, that embedded narrative, he tells her his whole story, and that takes a while. And then Venus sends down, in the guise of Aeneas's son, her own son, Cupid, and makes Dido fall in love with Aeneas. And Aeneas is not going to reject the advances of a beautiful queen. He is a player at heart, or at least that's how he seems in this next episode with Dido. So they have this famous cave scene together. It's honestly, it is the most fanfiction-y thing of the whole. Well, yeah. Actually, I'm going to take that back. Well, it has the spirit of fanfiction. There's other instances where there's a more explicit fanfiction element where there's some name dropping that makes no sense if you think about it. But this is so fanfiction-y. The cave scene. Oh, they were trapped in a storm. Like, they need to go into the cave together. Oh no, there's only one bed. Like, not really, but I guess they have to, like, sleep together, you know, and
they just have to do it.
So this, I don't really know if there's, well, actually, I do think there is a kind of strange parallel if you think about it. Either, okay, I can see two. There's two scenes in Homer that where they go to bed, and one is Paris and Helen,
mm-hmm.
where Paris is swept up from the battle and is plopped right into Helen's bed,
mm-hmm.
and right in the middle of the battle, and they have some fun. And then the other one I'm thinking of is when Odysseus returns home,
mm-hmm.
and Penelope kind of tests him, like, about the marriage bed, and then mm-hmm. they reunite, and I think it's kind of implied that,
yeah,
they're gonna, you know, sleep together again. And I sort of like the second one, although if you see both of them in it, it kind of is a funny parallel, because you have Aeneas on the one hand, kind of like Paris and Helen. This is not his wife. This is an affair. They haven't consecrated anything.
Right.
But on the other hand, it's like an inverted, or like a perverted almost, version of Odysseus and Penelope.
Right.
Where, because they're not married, but they're acting like it.
Mm-hmm.
But this is not his home. We all know mm-hmm. he's leaving.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not really his, like, oh, coming home, reuniting with a wife. It's
right.
Like, so interesting that this cave scene is embedded in here.
Yeah. I mean, Dido, like, represents qualities of so many Homeric characters, right? Like Calypso and Circe, you know, she threatens to kind of detain Aeneas from his ultimate journey, like Calypso and Circe did for Odysseus. Also, in interesting ways, she kind of represents Nausicaa, the princess of the Phaeacian court in the Odyssey. But I think your points about Penelope and Helen are also really interesting. Yeah, Dido, like, because she's a real historical figure, but also encompasses all of these Homeric women. I think the perfect embodiment of fan fiction. Virgil was like, let's just sprinkle in everything here.
Yeah.
And I mean, Cleopatra too. Like, we can't forget about her. Like, if you were a Roman in the first century BC.
Oh, yeah.
And you were reading about an Eastern African queen, you were thinking of Cleopatra.
And also, hence Mark Antony and his affair.
Exactly.
And how he has a Roman wife, conveniently Augustus's sister, waiting at home.
And instead, he's being distracted by this Eastern temptress.
Eastern debauchery.
Exactly.
So, yeah, I did think about Calypso and Odysseus in the sense that what really struck me were Dido's speeches. Because Penelope and Helen don't really have those kinds of speeches that are filled with resentment or, you know, and maybe it's because in some ways they don't seem to hold as much power as Calypso. Like, Calypso's a goddess. Like, you know, she's, and Dido seems to have in some ways more power as queen than maybe than a Helen or Penelope.
And I think it's also like just the circumstances that they find themselves in. Like, Aeneas has come to Dido's city and asked Dido for help. Like, she really holds all the cards here.
But then because she's in love and they have this cave scene, which we should talk about, there's some interesting things that go down here.
Yeah.
So, and if you've, if you have taken a Latin course on the Aeneid, please forgive us for going over these details, which I'm sure every student has looked over. But when they're in the cave and they're sleeping together, the Earth and Juno give these marriage signs. Lightning is likened to bridal torches. Wood nymphs are apparently singing wedding songs far away. And then there's a great line, Dido called the lawlessness a marriage and with phrases veiled her shame. So, I mean, it's interesting because on the one hand, Virgil is telling us what happened. And then on the other hand, you feel like maybe you're in Dido's head a little bit. And she's doing what a lot of girls do, which is reading too much into the signs. And
planning the wedding on the first date.
Yeah, and getting ahead of herself a little bit and assuming that Aeneas is on the same page as her and that this is meaning to him as much as it is to her. And then also you feel like Virgil's really laying some judgment down. Like, phrases veiled her shame. Like, shame that it was out of wedlock, I guess, or shame that, they weren't married.
Yeah, I mean, a big part of it is that Dido had pledged to remain loyal to her dead husband, who, after he was killed, she left Tyre. And a bunch of different kings around Carthage, her new city, had been trying to marry her. And she was like, no, I'm loyal to my old husband. Not going to do it. But then, of course, now with Aeneas, she's been influenced by Venus and Cupid. So I think there is kind of a cognitive dissonance where she doesn't necessarily want to be doing any of this, but it's not her choice per se. She's being influenced pretty heavily by the gods.
I mean, and you can't help but think of Penelope surrounded by the suitors, you know, who want to marry her, and she just resists. And then you see Dido, who's like, pledged herself to her dead husband, and then here comes Aeneas and boom,
all bets off.
So, and then of course Aeneas is not staying there, they're not married, he has again his loyal Roman wife waiting for him in Italy, so he must be off, and plenty of people come down to him and say, come on, like, you gotta go, you can't stay here forever. This is just lust, you know, this is not the woman waiting for you. So he goes to Dido, kind of shamefully embarrassed. Hey, I'm actually leaving. And Dido is kind of like Calypso here, pissed. She's like, how dare you? We were together.
We were married.
We were married. We loved each other. And he was like, well, technically, we were never married, so I actually don't owe you anything. And that was like, his speech is the closest you'll get to a kind of modern player. Just,
it's pretty bad.
I don't want to say the word I'm thinking of, but
yeah,
player who just is like, actually, it's your fault. Like, we weren't married. Like, what are you talking about? I never said I love you actually in those words. I just kind of slept with you and I'm leaving. So
it's gaslighting. Bye. Yeah, it's pretty bad.
You know, at least Calypso is kind of like, hey, I kept him here, but he, you know, the male gods have, you know, affairs all the time and no one gets mad at them for stealing these women, mortal women, and keeping them. Why can't I do the same?
Mm-hmm.
So at least she's kind of honest about the situation, but no one's honest in this situation.
No.
With Aeneas and Dido. And it doesn't end well. Aeneas leaves and then Dido kills herself in this really dramatic pyre situation,
yeah,
deceiving everyone. And that's kind of the end of it. Sort of sad. It's like, you don't, Aeneas doesn't really get any retribution again, like no punishment for that.
Well, really. It's interesting. And this is another like way that Virgil is kind of writing like historical fan fiction almost. As Dido kills herself, she utters a curse against Aeneas and his descendants, meaning the Romans, and says that, you know, oh, someone is going to come, you know, a Carthaginian in the future is going to avenge me. And, you know, unless you know your Roman history, this doesn't mean much. But for Virgil's original audience, to them, this meant the Punic Wars. So when Dido curses Aeneas, she's basically saying, our descendants are going to hate each other. They're going to be bitter enemies, the Romans and the Carthaginians. There's going to be no love between them ever. And of course, you know, later on, that's exactly what would happen. The Romans and the Carthaginians would hate each other terribly and fight several wars until, ironically for Dido, Rome ended up absolutely destroying Carthage and like razing the city to the ground. So Dido, her suicide kind of looks forward to the Punic Wars and unfortunately the destruction of her own city. So there are so many different ways that Virgil is like using the Aeneid to kind of predict future events of Roman history.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting. So like, it's not really a curse. It's a curse against Aeneas, but it really is to justify the history in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And but the weirdest part about it, like you said, is like, but the curse is actually a curse against herself.
Yeah.
She's like again getting played. It's like,
yeah.
It's interesting. I wonder what Virgil had in mind, as I'm sure many people wonder.
Yeah.
But moving on from Carthage, he does successfully leave and he eventually after a couple stops along the way, ends up at Cumae, where he goes to the underworld. And this is another major scene, again, echoing Odysseus going to the underworld. Although Odysseus, it happens in a different way.
The underworld comes to him.
That's the best way to put it. And you could argue, and when I was reading up on this, I saw an analysis that said this makes Aeneas the better, the stronger hero,
yeah,
that he was able to actually go open the door to hell and go to the underworld and then come back, and Odysseus just brought the underworld to him. But I don't know. Or it means that, like, I don't know what it means. It's just interesting. But this is where you get the famous line that was just recently quoted in a popular movie. The descent into hell is easy, right?
Yeah.
So the Sibyl at Cumae says that. And actually, we visited one of the supposed spots of,
yeah,
where the Sibyl
her
was.
Cave. Mm-hmm.
And like in real life, if that is where it was, it's a kind of tunnel that goes down. Well, it goes deep and then down.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I would describe it. It's like,
yeah,
a tunnel wall. And then you get to this like staircase that goes all the way down. And I remember you could keep going down, but everyone was scared because it's dark.
It's really creepy.
It's really a strange place. But in the Aeneid, there's 100 cave openings,
mm-hmm,
and she speaks really loud through them. And Apollo's like making her frenzied and everything. But essentially she says, okay, you want to go to the underworld? Like, you need to go into the forest and you find a golden bough. That means you're destined to go to the underworld and you can use that to, you know, cross in and go, mm-hmm, and visit these spirits and talk to them. So he goes down, he crosses, he sees a lot of the suffering that's involved in the underworld.
Including Dido.
Including Dido. And that I love this scene because he's like, hey, like, remember what we had? OMG, I can't believe you're dead. Like, I can't believe we're like, crossing paths here. Whoa, what's up? And she doesn't
refuses to engage.
Refuses to engage. Good for her. She turns away and remains with her husband. Well, her husband's shade. They're dead, obviously. So, yeah.
But she sort of got her happy ending in that sense.
In a twisted way, she's
arguably
reunited with her husband. And then Aeneas also sees some Greek shades and they run away from him. There's some interactions. But eventually, his main goal, he talks with his father. And this mirrors in so many ways, and in so many ways doesn't mirror, Odysseus speaking with Tiresias, who is the blind prophet.
Mm-hmm.
Who tells him how he's going to get home.
Right.
But Anchises has a lot more to offer than just how he's going to get to his next place.
Oh, yes, he does.
So who does he point out, like, the big one?
I mean, Marcellus, I think.
I was thinking Caesar, but you're right.
Well,
I guess they're both important.
There's a whole parade of Roman heroes.
Oh, yeah.
So,
and which is very triumphal, if you think about it.
Oh, absolutely. It's definitely modeling, like, you know, Roman military parades. And it's interesting. So Virgil is kind of using here, like, the Platonic idea of reincarnation. Metempsychosis is the technical philosophical term for it, which means that, you know, souls after they die would go drink from the river Lethe, forget their past life, and then come back and be reincarnated into a new body, a new life. So what Anchises shows to Aeneas is all of the souls who are going to become the glorious Romans of the future. And he, like, identifies them. Anchises is telling Aeneas, and Aeneas has no idea what any of this means. Aeneas, like we said earlier, Aeneas doesn't found Rome. Like, Aeneas, you know, has no sense that Rome is going to be this big, important city. So, I mean, this is like, I would almost call it like fan service in a way. Like, this is not serving any plot purpose. Like, this is purely for Virgil's Roman audience who know all of these figures from the past, from the recent contemporary present. And so for that reason, I think it's one of readers' favorite parts because it does feel like fan service.
And this is the most explicit fan fiction that I was talking about where, you know, some of the heroes make sense. You're like, okay, these are like, you know, I mean, descendants, the will-be descendants of Aeneas. He points out like his son and then his son's son and goes through. And you're like, but as it gets less and less mythological and, you know, then he's like Caesar or like, I think Romulus is also mentioned.
Yeah.
And then, and there's Caesar, the wonderful Augustus. And you're like, oh, right. He's the patron of Virgil.
Maecenas.
Maecenas was the patron, but Maecenas was besties with Augustus. So Caesar is mentioned and he says would eventually come from the line of Ascanius and Rome will reach a golden age of rule over the world. So golden age. I mean, it's interesting that it's an interesting time that like Virgil's writing this because obviously Augustus we think just conquered Egypt, so it does seem like he's ushering in a golden age. We know he kind of does, but at the time they don't know exactly what's going to happen. They don't know that Rome's going to reach these great heights and conquer all this, you know, conquer so much of Europe and this and surrounding areas. So it's interesting, and you know, Greece too. Like, this is harkening back to a time when Greece was extremely powerful and conquering. But the reality is that that's not the case anymore. Greece is more like a museum that the Romans go to and get educated there and then come back and they know all the Greek stuff, but the Greeks are not powerful anymore.
And that's actually part of Anchises' speech to Aeneas. He has these pretty famous lines where he talks about, like, you know, I'll leave art and sculpture and poetry and astrology to the Greeks, which is actually ironic because, of course, Virgil, a Roman, is saying, like, leave the poetry to the Greeks. But that's another point. But then he says, you know, your task, Roman, and it's interesting, he calls Aeneas a Roman, is basically to be powerful in war. So he kind of, Anchises divides, like, culture and art and literature and leaves that to the Greeks. But then for the Romans, you know, they're going to be powerful with their military.
Adama uidumque cano.
Exactly.
So then, like you said, another major figure that's pointed out, which this is just Virgil taking absolute liberty. And I do wonder, I think if I was a poet and I wrote this and I included this person and then I was about to die, I would say, actually burn this because this is not good enough to be like my last big work. The fact that I mentioned this person. So he mentions Marcellus, who is Augustus's sister, Octavia's son, first son by her first marriage. And he is, when he's growing up, he seems like he's going to be the heir to Augustus. So he's like a really important, he's like the princeling of Rome. Everyone loves him. Everyone wants him to be the heir. You know, they want him to take on Augustus's role after he dies. And they're kind of like grooming him for that. But he dies at 20 years old, very young. And in the poem, Virgil, you know, alludes to this sad fate because Aeneas is like, oh, who's that really beautiful boy over there? And why does he look so sad? And Anchises is like, let me tell you, he has a sad fate. The gods showed us just a little of what splendor, like, of Rome could have been, just a taste of what it could be, but they took it away because they felt like it would make, if they let this boy live, it would have made Rome too powerful. And you know what? The funny thing is, looking back at history, there is kind of something to that, because Augustus, one of his main issues with carrying on his legacy is that he can't find a suitable heir, and everyone that he wants dies tragically and young, whether by coincidence or and he ends up with Tiberius,
last choice.
Literally in his will he says, I would never have given it to him if it was my choice, but ultimately it has to be him. So the fact that Virgil included Marcellus, it's kind of crazy because, I mean, it just shows what an important role he played at the time, because otherwise he wouldn't have been in this.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where the fan fiction reaches new heights. He's Virgil supposedly personally performed, and I don't know if it's performed the whole, I assume the whole poem, but it also might have just been this part, to both Augustus and Octavia, and that they both cried. And it was this super dramatic thing because obviously it was her son and his nephew who they both loved a lot. And it's just interesting. And there's actually a painting. I should have looked up where it is. There's a painting.
I think it's in the Art Institute in Chicago.
I think it might be. There's a painting of Virgil performing it to Augustus and Octavia. So I urge you to look that painting up.
Yeah.
This is not just like maybe it didn't happen, but this is a well-known story that surrounds this crazy name drop that Virgil does.
Yeah.
So
with that, should we talk a little bit more about Virgil's relationship to Augustus?
Yeah, I mean, we alluded to the fact that his patron was Maecenas, mm-hmm. who was childhood best friends with Augustus, a really important figure.
Interestingly, not really a political figure.
Maecenas,
he was an equestrian, so he was super rich, unbelievably rich, and, you know, a member of the elite, but never, like, really got involved in any of the political offices, never posed a threat. He's sort of considered like Augustus's kind of head of culture, which is kind of anachronistic. But Maecenas was the literary patron of a really important and influential circle of poets, including Virgil. And Virgil, so this was not, you know, his first work. He'd previously written a couple of other poems. Those are called the Eclogues and the Georgics. And interestingly, those are both kind of rural agricultural works.
Well, Virgil is a farm boy. He comes from the country.
Virgil's a farm boy. His poems, they're not really like realistic depictions of the countryside. And I mean, even though Virgil came from the countryside, like he was still wealthy. Like his family was
rich.
Well, yes,
he wasn't a farm. He wasn't farming the land, but he didn't grow up in the like urban Rome.
No. So his first two works are, you know, they're about the countryside, but also in interesting ways, both of them are still kind of about politics and especially the devastation of the civil wars on the countryside of Italy. So Virgil, like already from the beginning of his career, was, I think, super interested in using poetry to explore political issues facing his generation. And of course, we see that come out very clearly in the Aeneid as he's using this mythological figure, as we've seen, to kind of point forward to events and figures in Roman history. But the Aeneid, I would stress, is on a much larger scale, much more ambitious than anything he had written before. And he was clearly kind of trying to create the new Homeric epic for Rome.
And I think what's interesting is, you know, in the millennia that has passed since his writing of it, a lot of people have argued, I mean, at first, I think it was taken almost point blank, not as propaganda, but as like, well, sort of as propaganda, but not with a negative connotation. I think at first, maybe it was definitely praised as an amazing piece of literature, the epitome of that golden age in mm-hmm. many ways, and just the standard in terms of Latin poetry
mm-hmm.
or a Latin epic. And, you know, obviously we still study it today, but especially in more recent times, and I say that with a very large sweeping recent mm-hmm. in the last 2000 years, there has been, you know, questions of, was it propaganda or was it actually trying to subvert Augustus's regime in some ways, or how was it dealing with that, and all these questions. And I mean, I think first it's interesting to note that Augustus and Virgil did have a relationship. Like mm-hmm. they knew each other. They were friendly. I think they wrote letters to each other. Like, well, they surely did write letters to each other. I mean, everyone wrote letters in that time. But yeah, you get the sense that he was in the inner circle.
Mm-hmm.
He was part of Maecenas. I mean, that crowd, the literary people that Augustus, you know, entertained and was friendly with. And in fact, I believe he had a treaty at Brundisium where he brought Horace, and there was also a treaty at Tarentum where he brought two poets. I think one of them was Horace. I think the other one was Varius. So he was kind of known, like he was friendly with these people. These were part of his circles. He trusted them. I think Augustus actually knew their importance in terms of the importance of literature.
Yeah, absolutely.
In conveying, you know, messages of peace, of golden age, like we see in the Aeneid. You know, this is totally, in many ways, it is a total stamp of approval of his, you know, reign. But there are arguments, because there's like, you know, and we were talking about this earlier, you know, before recording, that Aeneas is kind of like, you know, he's this hero, Trojan hero. There's great qualities that he has. But on the other hand, he kind of sucks. He's kind of a horrible guy. He like sleeps with this woman and then leaves her. And it's not like sleeping with a goddess where you're compelled. Like, he wasn't compelled. He could have not slept with her and said, oh, no, actually, yeah. I don't want to.
And he knew he had this fate to found a civilization in Italy, and still he chose instead to stay in Carthage for a year with Dido. But I think the more kind of condemning action is at the very end of the poem, which is, you know, I mean, one of the big questions about the Aeneid, because Virgil died before he officially finished it, is, was this the ending that he intended? Did he, you know, was he going to add more to this? But the Aeneid, as we have it, ends with Aeneas confronting his enemy Turnus, who's one of the Italic, you know, heroes, resisting Aeneas after he arrives in Italy. And they're fighting in one-to-one combat. Turnus is defeated. It's very clear. You know, he begs for mercy. He says, like, I'm done. You know, I yield, whatever. Please just spare my life. And Aeneas does not. He refuses. He kills Turnus. And earlier I mentioned Anchises in the underworld describing to Aeneas how the Romans would be this kind of militaristic power. And something that Anchises specifically says is, you know, go fight, you know, conquer, get an empire with your military, but your task is to, you know, put down the proud and to spare the defeated. And what does Aeneas do at the end? He doesn't spare the defeated. He kills Turnus instead. And so it raises this big question of, like, you know, why does Aeneas, the proto-Roman, not do what a Roman should do? And how does that then reflect back on Augustus? And of course, Augustus himself had a lot of, you know, actions in his past against his enemies that he might have wanted the Romans to forget, especially the proscriptions, right? In the civil wars, Augustus, as Octavian, was responsible for the deaths of a lot of Romans. And, you know, then once he comes to power and is restoring peace, like, you know, how does that past inform the present? And I think these are questions that Virgil is kind of raising for his readers to grapple with.
And I think I will point out, not in defense of Aeneas, because I don't actually particularly like him of all the heroes that are introduced by Homer, but he does see Turnus wearing the belt of Pallas, I think, the little boy who is killed by Turnus. And I think he was going to spare Turnus's life, but he sees that and he takes revenge. It's in a moment of anger. And also notable to point out, all this is unrelated to that a little bit, that Turnus was promised to Lavinia to be married. It was kind of arranged through Lavinia's mother, I believe, that like Turnus was going to marry Lavinia and that was what was going to happen. And so Aeneas coming in and it's being like, actually, I'm marrying Lavinia, although I don't think he sets that up at all. It was the father of Lavinia, I think, that kind of arranges that. We're skipping over the last two books here in a major way, but essentially there are kind of, it's the reason I bring that up with the whole, he was promised to Lavinia that Turnus was, is because, you know, when Odysseus comes back and he fights the suitors, it's a really bloody scene. And he also kills like the women in the house, the slaves working there. And although none of them are really promised to Penelope, you could say maybe Penelope was kind of semi-promised to one of them, like whoever gets her. It was kind of implied that that was what maybe should happen. Although, of course, the whole epic is, you know, questioning that. And so, like, it's interesting when we're comparing Aeneas to figures like Achilles and Odysseus, which are, like, the obvious heroic counterparts. You could also argue that Odysseus and Achilles, they are very complex figures. Achilles, obviously, like, he lets his wrath and his hate and his anger get the best of him, and he doesn't fight at first. And then, there's some kind of, like, there's flaws there. And then the same with Odysseus, like he's wily and crafty, but he's almost lying and false in some ways, kind of shifty and not trustworthy. And then he's very violent when he meets the suitors and all those people. And you could kind of see that maybe Virgil was echoing those flaws mixed with virtues in Aeneas in the same way. And that by having him be violent and do all these things and have this complicated relationship, like a complicated character, he's actually allowing Augustus as their new heroic figure to be like, hey, well, if Achilles, Odysseus, and Aeneas could be complex and have their faults and sometimes be a little bit mortal and sometimes be divine, like, that's so normal. That's exactly how Augustus is. Like, yes, he did the prescriptions. Yes, he had the civil wars, but sometimes violence is necessary. Sometimes it is unforgivable and you have to kill them. Sometimes that's just what you need to do to establish a golden age. And so you could read, on the other hand, there is some kind of affirming to it, to the poem. But like, ultimately, we're never going to know what Virgil felt about it.
And I mean, I think like bringing up, right, because another important thing to point out here is that Virgil had the option of writing an epic poem that was explicitly about Augustus, right? He could have written an epic poem like narrating the Battle of Actium, for example, but he didn't. He chose to use this mythological figure. And I think doing it in that indirect way allows us, if we want to see this as kind of, you know, a positive reflection on Augustus, right? Augustus is not Aeneas. He's descended from Aeneas. So he can inherit many of those positive qualities, but then also he's representing an improvement of the past, right? He's moving on from the violence of the past and establishing a peaceful future. So I think we don't have to read it as either, you know, straightforward praise of Augustus or completely subversive of Augustus. I think Virgil is telling a really complicated narrative.
Yeah, I mean, because it's hard to ignore, you know, you think about all these parallels we've brought up, not only with Homer, but with their own history and their own present time,
mm-hmm.
with Cleopatra, Mark Antony, Augustus. You just can't erase that. That was on their mind. That was their moment in time when this poem, this was, I mean, and that's the turning point, a major turning point in history, was the foundation of the Roman Empire. So you can't just throw away and say, oh, well, maybe he was just kind of saying that and he wasn't thinking about it and there was no purpose. Like, there was definitely, there was reasoning behind it. He thought about it. He labored over it. And he was definitely pulling in from so many areas, you know, history, literature, everything. And so, you know, we're not going to know exactly what he was implying. And I think the beauty of literature is that you're not really supposed to know what the author
mm-hmm.
was thinking. I think the beauty is that we get to 2000 years later, read it and interpret it how we think about it. And it, and the questions it asks is like just the important themes of life that we have to ask about then as we have to ask about now in our present day.
Beautifully said.
And that's all we have time for today.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Dead Language Ladies.
And stay tuned for our next episode.
Wale!
Kaere!